You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 13th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. A successful zine grows into a stunning biennial, a new Australian magazine about man's best friend, and more print pics than you can poke a Chromeleon at from Mag Culture's Jeremy Leslie. The proofs are on the wall for edition 33 of The Stack. Greetings from Studio One in Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll meet Rachel Maria Taylor, the editorial director of the new creative lifestyle magazine, Another Escape.
I brought in Boat Magazine, mostly because I just love how they focus on one kind of city, more of a less spoken about city, and really try and get to the nitty gritty of it.
And we'll pause to hear the tale of a new dog magazine coming from Melbourne.
It was asked by the shelter dog that she was volunteering at to record the actual dogs that were in their books, to say something. And she just fell in love with the whole thing and made it into like a full series.
All that, plus a chat with the editor of Little Joe, coming up today on edition 33 of The Stack. Greetings from Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards, standing in for our editor-in-chief and regular Stack host, Tyler Brulé, who's in Okinawa today, brokering a peace deal for the Korean Peninsula. Today, Studio One is once again full of creatives and editors who are champions of the printed page. Plenty of intriguing magazine yarns from around the world this week. Syria's first gay magazine, Mawala, has been published. The latest in a really fascinating trend for free expression in and around the country. A weekly paper, Free Syria, published in Gaziantep in Turkey, puts across an interesting ideological viewpoint endorsing pluralism, moderate Islam, and democracy. It's a thriving media scene, not only there, but all around the world. I'm sure today's guests would agree. Let's meet them now. Our first guest is the editorial and creative director of the new creative lifestyle magazine, Another Escape. Rachel Maria Taylor has also worked with the editorial team of Boat Magazine and is part of the Kogo Art Collective. Rachel, welcome to The Stack. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi.
Here at Midori House. Tell me a little bit then about this journey of Another Escape from zine to magazine. What were the sort of the motivations in bringing it into the form we see before us today?
Basically, myself and my co-editor, JD Daunton, we were really inspired by people that were out there that were doing what it was that they wanted to do, what excited them, what inspired them. Before, when it was the zine, it was more about creatives that were doing that, that were pushing the boundaries and being innovative. But then we wanted to take that one step further. We wanted to question, actually, what creativity was, and in a broader sense of what that actually meant, and people being imaginative across all creative practices, whatever that meant. So we wanted to look at that on a deeper level in this kind of new editorial direction for Another Escape. And it kind of just came from there, really. We wanted it to be bigger, better, and just much more quality content.
And you say sort of bigger and better. I guess that also brings with it pressures from a zine to a magazine. Were you sort of very conscious of that? Was that something you were aware of? Was it a worry, or was it just a challenge that you were looking
to embrace?
It was
a worry, but it was something that we just kind of went with. I mean, there's a big difference to what we were and to what we are, and especially kind of the audience as well that we're looking to have with it. Before, it was very much kind of just focused on having creatives involved, and that was our audience as well. And it still is, but we're looking to open that up. As I said, we're looking for like a broader notion of what creativity can be, and anybody can be creative, and it's looking for that.
Absolutely. That's a good positive message. I just wondered, in terms of your own background, have you always worked in magazines? There's a lot of broad creative influences. What's your own sort of path to where you're at now?
I trained as an illustrator, and I think that's where I kind of found this joy for storytelling. And I explored that in different ways. And then I ended up with Boat, and it came quite naturally for me to create holistic stories, whether that be writing, drawing, or photographing. And then to kind of wanting to take that one step further and have an editorial that fully like explored all of those avenues. That's kind of where I came from. That's my journey, and I'm still exploring that as well.
Gustav, I just wondered, you mentioned about co-editing the magazine. How does that process work? Is it complicated? Is it
these,
you know, you have bands, you have these kind of creative fallings out. Is it that kind of dynamic, or is it something that works very
smoothly? No, I think we both bring something quite different to the table. And Jodie is from a photography background. So even though we're both visual image makers, though that's what we've trained to do, we still bring something very different. And to both have a creative influence and over the editorial content, it works well, and it's a good dynamic. And we also have another assistant editor involved as well. She's pretty heavily involved, called Louise Bing, who actually also has a background in illustration. And it works really well.
A good creative mix to the process there. Our second guest is a familiar voice on the stack. Jeremy Leslie is the man behind Mag Culture, a company that specialises in content design for print and advice to publishers. Jeremy, welcome back to the stack. Just to pick up with you, I mean, you were writing a book, I think. How's that coming along?
That's completed now. That's been a big project for me over the last sort of 18 months. On and off, final stages. It's all done and dusted. It's the hardest part of any project is the front cover. We're just sorting that out at the moment.
Always lots of pressure for a print connoisseur to get that right.
Absolutely.
Now, I know one thing you're always doing is pitching up at sort of big magazine events, this kind of thing. What's been happening out on the sort of magazine circuit lately? Have you been catching up with anyone interesting, or been particularly drawn to any particular events or areas?
It's been a bit quiet recently. I mean, there's I say that there's always something going on. The big thing for me at the moment is people keep asking about the number of magazines that are being published, the number of new magazines that are or are not being published. There's been quite a lot of attention in the press, and I think partly through the blog, but clearly also through the stack here as well. There's a growing interest in the smaller independent magazines, and people want to know how many, you know, how significant a movement is this. Is there a movement? And so there's a general theme going through a lot of what I'm doing at the moment is talking about that and trying to get an understanding about how many of these magazines there are. And there seems to me there are increasing numbers at the moment. I run an evening event in Shoreditch every couple of months with Steve Watson, who's been another guest with you. We run Printout together, and that's been growing in size and interest. So there's a lot of interesting things happening in the independent sector. I must be probably receiving 5 to 10 magazines a week, new magazines, new projects. It's very busy. It's a busy time.
Fantastic. That's what we like to hear,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And across the print sector, I suppose, I mean, one thing that intrigues me as a sort of former newspaper person, there's still, despite, again, and that's another sector, people talk about contractions, particularly here in the UK, but there's robust areas. The fillet of the independent newspaper, sales above 300,000. Mm-hmm. And I like to feel I had a personal stake in that, as I used to work there when it was launched. But it's encouraging, isn't it? New titles. Some newspapers managing to buck the trend. Mm-hmm. We often look at this issue, it's doom and gloom, but this is not all about contraction, is it? There's a lot of things still happening. It's still quite vibrant out there.
It is. And I think it's very easy. It makes for a very kind of sexy headline to say this is dying, this is the new thing. And it's very easy to kind of get very binary about it, but it's much more complicated than that. And I think it's... if you talk in percentages, you can always make a story look like there's doom and gloom. But actually, if you look at what the percentages of, there's still a huge amount of print out there. There's a large number of launches in the independent sector. I agree, the mainstream sector is suffering much more dramatically. But I think there's also a lot of people. You know, I think name.
Rachel.
Sorry. But I was thinking, I think, you know, hearing Rachel talk about Another Escape and talking about it growing from being a fanzine into a magazine is typical of a lot of people are doing with editorial projects online. They're developing from one thing to another. They're developing their voices and developing into more and more into magazines and editorial projects.
Now, Rachel, we'll talk more about Another Escape later in the programme in more detail, but I just wondered, in terms of the that sort of broad area of magazines, it is in quite robust health. There are quite a number of interesting sort of travel-oriented magazines out there. When you look across the sort of competition, if you will, do you view it as that? Is it competition, or is there a sort of a spirit of camaraderie? Do you look and think, oh, they've done a good job with that, and
yeah,
I wish
definitely.
We'd got there first? What's the dynamic?
I mean, obviously there's going to be healthy competition, but I think if they individually have strong, clear editorial voices, then they each hold their own. And I would say that most of the magazines on the market, these independent ones coming up, they want to have their own voice, so they're going to strive for that. That's how they're going to survive, I hope. I wouldn't say it's rivalry or competition as such. And my experience of it is everybody's really happy to help. They want to get to know each other. They want to interact and offer each other things. So, yeah, no.
It's a good. There's a lot of camaraderie out there, I think. It's just interesting, isn't it, looking at the actual personnel. We had the editor of Q, Andrew Harrison, who's resigned not that long in the job, 14 months or so. When you're thinking about that landscape, the competition between titles, how important is it, do you think, to have, you know, a strong sort of figurehead at the front of your magazine as that editorial presence? Is it just about editorial content, or do you think you need those driving forces? How much of a difference, for example, can, you know, the editorship make of a magazine that's maybe not doing as well as it used to do, perhaps?
I think it's the key to the project is the both on the editorial side and the creative direction side. I think those are the key figures stroke teams, but you need figureheads who are going to step forward and be the magazine. We're sitting in the offices of Monocle, and that's a perfect example where you have a figurehead who's very, very forthright and very present in the industry. And I think that's essential if you're going to make a success of your magazine, it's a key part of an editor's role is to represent the magazine in the broadest sense through other media and offering opinion and points of view. Vital.
And Rachel, I wonder, I mean, how sort of aware of that are you then when you sort of embark on a project or ramp a project up to the next level, that there is that additional expectation to be this, if not a visionary, but to be a figurehead, to maybe, you know, make the press appearances, drive the agenda forward? Is that something that maybe surprised you somewhat, that there were those expectations, or were you sort of willing to go along with that from the outset?
I think there are surprises. I mean, it's a very different feeling from actually kind of having to be out there and your name being part of it to actually being sat at your desk hiding behind your emails. It is very different. But I think it's something, it's good to embrace. And if you believe in what it is, that your product, your magazine, then, you know, you should be a part of it.
I mean, I'd like to ask you both, really, going maybe back to sort of the infancy of your magazine enthusiasm, were there any particular editors that you always used to watch out for, you know, the decisions they made or the magazines they led, or whose work you particularly admired? Were there particular people who really sort of made an impact on you when your sort of magazine enthusiasm began?
Well, I can bore you at length about a number of magazines.
Please do.
I can go back to the kind of the days when something like NME was Inky, a weekly tabloid paper, and it had a competitor called Sounds, and they had completely different editorial tones. And I liked NME over Sounds, and even though I was too young to appreciate that it came from a culture imbued from the editor down, that's, you know, looking back, it was quite clear to me that I wanted to pick up one magazine over the other because of the way that it directed its approach to the same content every week, but it was just a different feel. And I think that's what gives the magazines their character. And I think, you know, there are lots of times when a new editor comes in and they can often struggle. You know, the magazines that have really inspired me are ones which have been, there's a launch editor who has really made something of that magazine. They've come in, they've been there from the very beginning. I think of Nick Logan at The Face and Terry Jones at ID right back at the beginning of this kind of my period of magazines being reinvented, if you like. And there are people, I think now I find a lot of the mainstream magazines have finally getting it and beginning to look back at some of the independent magazines and look back a couple of decades to a time when the editors had much more control rather than the publisher and the budget line. And I think you're beginning to get some of the mainstream magazines now beginning to catch up with that. And instead of wanting to appeal to everyone, identify a group they're appealing to and go for them and really make people love them rather than, you know, have quality relationships rather than quantity relationships.
Absolutely. I mean, Roach, do you have any sort of particular people you admired or you'd like to try and emulate, perhaps? I don't know. Anyone stand out?
I wouldn't say necessarily as an editorial team. I mean, I take magazines quite at face value. I like to be engaged with the content more than trying to find out about the people behind it. But, I mean, that's always going to be a projection of them, isn't it? There isn't editors or teams. I think it's more about the content and just finding, I mean, magazines change as well a lot, so yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting stuff. I'm sure we'll touch upon more of these ideas later in the programme, but you're listening to The Stack. We'll be back soon to meet the Melbourne-based editor who has sniffed out an interesting niche in the Australian canine publishing market.
Grasse is legendary when it comes to the alchemy of perfume making. Monocle's film crew travel to the south of France to discover a new generation inheriting these traditions and making them their own.
My first souvenirs, we were working with flowers with my sister, trying to create and invent and of course sell some perfumes from our own. So yes, it was in our DNA, but perfume is a wonderful world and we're very lucky to have that in the family.
Making Sense, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Four and Sons is a magazine where, they say, dogs and culture collide. A year into their life as a digital publication, the Melbourne-based editorial team have just released their first print edition. It's beautifully designed, somewhat stately look into the world of dogs and art, a global survey of hounds as either subject or muse. Monocle's Patrick Pittman caught up with editor-in-chief Marta Rocca to ask her about where the idea for this ambitious dog of a project came from.
One of my friends, she's actually a dog crazy person. And we've always wanted to do something together. She comes from a marketing background, but she ended up starting a line of dog accessories. And then I come from that publishing graphic design background. And we love like working together. So that's how the first idea of bringing everything we love from art to design to dogs to fashion in one spot.
Was dog publishing a thing out there when you were looking at, obviously there are lots of dog magazines around the world, but this particular kind of thing that you were doing, was there anything else out there that you could see?
We haven't found anything that it is in the same vein. I mean, there is what you're saying, there is a lot of what we call, and it's not disrespect, like, but the doggy magazines, which obviously cover more like grooming and health and all of those things. And then there's a few blogs that are mixing that and introducing an element of maybe pop culture or just, you know, more lighthearted elements as part of their content. But there's probably only another blog coming from Austria that is about art and dogs combined, and then another one called Dogs Art Today that's from the States. So, yeah, not many people out there just yet.
Let's just talk a little bit about the design aesthetic of the magazine, because it's quite, for anybody who, if we were to say a dog publication, they probably have a certain idea in their head, even with what we've already talked about, but it's got a very striking, very particular aesthetic. Do you want to talk about some of the inspirations behind that?
From the beginning, the work had to be displayed like art, in the sense of the purpose of this publication was to celebrate our first anniversary and celebrate the artist. So the work had to be really respected and really well displayed. The words have to be crafted properly. Like, we really want to push the editorial part of it as like an element of strength, not just, I mean, it's obviously, it's a very visual content, but there was had to be a sort of a subtlety and a respect for also like the words and also the images. So it's kind of quite, how can I say, restrained and I think clean, and I think it's just basically, yeah, trying to be respectful of the content.
Do you find dog people have specific tastes in the kind of creativity that you cover in the magazine?
I think that a lot of people, it's been a little bit that case of, I didn't know that's what I wanted, but now that you put it in front of me, that's exactly what I wanted. So not many people was thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great that there was a magazine that covered this? But the feedback, it's been amazing of course, how we didn't think about this earlier.
So let's take a look at the magazine itself and some of the stuff you've got in here. Who's this dog on the cover?
Actually, it's a shelter dog shot by Treya Scott, who started to this project called Shelter Dogs as a bit of a love project. And it was asked by the shelter dog that she was volunteering at to record the actual dogs that were in their books, to say something. And she just fell in love with the whole thing and made it into like a full series. This one's called Shady. And he's actually looking quite shady.
So what are some of the other things that we've got in this issue that are your favourite things?
There is the good thing is that there's a bit of a variety. Like there's, for example, the work of like Theodore Humphrey with Maddie, which has kind of become a little bit of a sensation. This coon hound that follows him around the world, and she just has an obsession, which apparently is part of the coon hound breed, to just jump on things. And that's such a beautiful, heartwarming project that he's been doing for the last over a year now.
Is she on some sort of small Statue of Liberty there in that one in Sandpoint?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And she's on top of like suitcases, she gets on top of like ladders, signs, guitars, anything like pipes sticking from buildings, obviously like post boxes, anything. Apparently that's just what she doesn't even need to be encouraged. That's her thing.
Seems like the sort of behaviour you're not supposed to encourage in dogs.
Yeah, I don't think she's like, I don't think she's just been, you know, ruled by rules.
Have you got plans to distribute the print version of the magazine internationally, given the broad base of content in there?
We are trying to reach as much as we can. At the moment, we are, because we have contributors in New York, or we have contributors in London, so through them, to like basically send them as much as we can, because we only printed like 2,000. It's not like 500, but it's not like a huge print run, and then for them to place them in a few kind of key selected locations and use it as a little bit of a platform to kind of get better known and be able to expand like properly towards the next one.
And you've become more of a dog person through the process of this?
Yes. I was introduced to it by accident. And yes, the more I get into this world, the more I appreciate it. And I absolutely love, the thing I really, really love is to see the relationship between humans and dogs.
And have you found your ideal dog yet?
You know what? I've always said a Labrador, but lately I've just been really loving French Bulldogs. My alter ego as a dog, if I was a dog, I would be a Dalmatian, because it's a whole graphic black and white thing. So, yes, there's a few favourites, I have to say, even I shouldn't say that, probably.
Is the evolution to Bulldog, is that as you're becoming more of a connoisseur, your tastes are refining, do you think?
I think it's because one thing, I've been exposed to them a lot lately, and I think because probably, yes, they are very popular at the moment, so you kind of, I guess, yeah, just rediscovering some breeds that maybe they weren't as popular before.
That was Monocle's Patrick Pittman speaking with the editor-in-chief of Four & Sons, Marta Rocco. Now, here in the studio, we're listening to that. Quite a lot of dog chat went on. We weren't so sure about breeds. We were thinking more size-wise, Not too small, maybe not too big. Is that a fair characterisation of our discussion?
I think that's a
pretty
good summation of what we're talking about. What maybe what we need is a copy of the magazine and we can start boning up.
Exactly, we could work out. It's interesting. I was going to ask, Rachel, in your magazine, leafing through, there's a couple of dog portraits in there.
Oh, yeah.
Page 98, my personal favourite.
Yeah.
This little guy in a kind of snowy scene. What do you make of that, Jeremy? I think that looks about, that looks kind of ideal to me. Not quite sure what kind of is it
husky,
some kind of husky, is it?
Yeah, yeah, huskiest.
I'm not actually sure.
And can I gather from that maybe dog portraiture won't be a recurring key theme?
It could be. I mean,
it's clearly a boom area of the industry. Jeremy, we talked here and there. Apparently, a lot of the magazines, the big popular ones, dog grooming, are they in your? In your regular collection? Any subscriptions?
I can't say they are. Oh. I can't. It's quite specialist, I think. if you go into any magazine store, it always amazes me the specialisation that you do get.
Absolutely.
To do with pets. Pets is an enormous area in publishing.
But no pet titles in your personal
Not yet. No.
What would be the ones then? If I was to come around and inspect your magazine archive, then what would be the sort of never missed? Subscription staples that you always make sure that you couldn't live without.
Okay, well, the one magazine I always make sure I resubscribe to is The New Yorker, which is a very easy one if you're into magazines. But I do still love that. In fact, I think they recently did a Dogs in New York special. Interestingly,
They have a rich history of dogs.
There's a lot of dogs in cartoons. Yes.
Particularly fine examples, I must say.
I think you'll probably find there's a lot of dogs in magazines, but as far as I'm aware, this Melbourne one is the first one that's actually specialised, brought it out in the open. But otherwise, must-haves include, I brought one along, Monoculture, German magazine, which always features one particular artist or creative person every time. The latest edition of that is about Kim Gordon, the artist and musician who was one of the founders of Sonic Youth.
Now, it's a slightly kind of smaller format, isn't it? But what was the kind of features? Is it quite long form pieces, or what's the sort of general style?
Well, it's quite a small format, but the magazine always appears in this sort of slightly sub A5 format, but it always comes as something different. And this one is, I will make the sound. Don't know if you get that.
That's a high quality.
There's a rubber band that holds it together, and it's a. Effectively, it's a bunch of little sort of cards and pieces and pullouts that fall apart and contain an interview. The magazine always has one long interview and is then kind of the format and design reflects the subject. And in this case, I think Gordon is somebody who's been involved in everything, as I say, from art to music. She had her own clothes label, X-Girl. And so, in a way, this is the format here. All the different parts reflect the way that she has so many parts.
That's really interesting. Rachel, what do you make of that format? Does that appeal to your aesthetic sensibilities?
So. I really like that. I think it's really... Yeah, no, it's great. I really like the way that bits pull out. You're kind of not sure which way you should be, like which order you should be reading it. It's very tactile, but you feel quite precious over it at the same time.
Interesting. So when you sort of see a new publication, especially now you're assessing the competition, for example, what's the first thing that strikes you? It has these tactile qualities? Maybe there's different elements to it, or is it still the cover the first thing that grabs you, or does it just depend on your mood? Perhaps?
Yeah, no, it depends a lot. I think your first impressions of it. That's got to be the main thing. I'm definitely one that likes to give a little stroke and see how the front cover feels. And then obviously you've got the kind of smell, the kind of way that you can flip through a magazine. First impressions, big deal, I think.
Very important. Now, it's interesting because obviously the sort of visual, I think people reading Another Escape will see, the imagery is really, really interesting. And again, nice, really nice stock. Do you have a space though in your heart for some of the kind of longer form stuff? I mean, Jeremy was mentioning reading, New Yorker, these sort of much longer essays and those kind of pieces. Do you have the patience that, or do you sort of separate that in your mind as a different kind of part of the discipline?
No. No, definitely. I like long form articles. I quite like getting quite deep into things. Definitely room for that. At the moment with Another Escape, it's kind of playing and trying to find what works. So we've kept it quite mixed up. There are longer ones in there, there's shorter ones, interviews, more kind of article-based ones. And I think it's just seeing the feedback that we get from it to see what works and, for the future. But personally, I love long form.
Good stuff. And I just wonder, in terms of, you mentioned their feedback, is that something that, again, you're conscious of? Or do you sort of think, well, look, my responsibility is to have this creative vision, ensure that I convey that and not be too influenced by what people think? How do you sort of reckon you'll deal with the balancing act between, you know, being reactive to what people say, maybe some constructive criticism even, if people have any, and then sort of sticking to your guns?
I think there definitely needs to be a balance drawn between it. You obviously have this kind of clear editorial kind of quality and content that you want, but I mean, I wouldn't be so naive to say I'm not going to listen to what works and what doesn't work, and I'm very open to hearing that. And I mean, we have quite a lot of people who contribute to it, who kind of get involved, and we like that, and we want to hear what people have got to say, because it can only make it better, really.
And Jeremy, it's interesting, isn't it, watching magazines sort of, I guess, in their infancy, when you sort of chart their progress, are you sort of aware of particular changes that are often made as magazines evolve and grow and develop? Or do you think that often the ones with the strongest kind of editorial vision manage to retain that and don't sort of change too much in their early stages?
I think there are those that... There's a bit of both. There are those that clearly, you know, as per our previous discussion about the editorial figure, there are those that have a very powerful direction and very well thought through plan, in a sense, and they just carry through on that, and they are relentless in their chasing that. And there are others who, by necessity, need to sort of respond a little bit. I think it's very important for that magazines. I think you mentioned it earlier, Rachel, it's very important that they do change. They are, that's one of the joys of them. I mean, there's they're tactile, they are physical things, and that's important. But also they develop and change and adapt and move on and respond to what other people do, both literally in terms of competition, but also in the wider world. They respond to what's around, and that's what's exciting about magazines.
Rachel, what are some of the other titles that you've maybe brought along today? Any other particular maybe recent discoveries or some old favourites, perhaps?
Well, Serial, definitely a recent discovery, which I love. I've fallen in love with. I brought the latest volume 2 along with me today. And
I think, is that the salt?
Yeah,
the salt,
yeah,
and pepper,
yeah,
issue.
Yeah,
we've been chatting about Serial in a recent edition of the Stack. So, yeah, it's a really, really aesthetically pleasing, I would say. That,
yeah,
isn't it?
The imagery is beautiful. The design is really simple. And I think it lends really well to the stories that they tell. And that is it for me. It's stories. You kind of become quite immersed in it. It's things that maybe you could maybe read about online, but not in the same way. And they have got an editorial voice, which is quite clear with that as well. And there's definitely an energy to Serial that you don't find, even though it's simple design, you kind of feel that they really love what they do. And that's why I like it.
Well, we'll be continuing to delve through your stacks of magazines during the show. We'll be back just after this, when we'll hear from another zine with big ambitions called Little Joe. Like creative hubs like Berlin and New York, London hums with the sound of zine printing. From architecture to gardening, communism, people with small budgets and big visions are committing their ideas to print. One title that stands out is Little Joe, started some 5 years ago as tribute to the gay rag trade of a long-lost era. The diminutive publication, with its essays, prose, and above all, intoxicating portrayal of queer glamour, has gained almost as much following as its subject matter. From Dusseldorf to Dallas, issues of Little Joe are flying off the shelves. Monocle's David Pleasant went to meet Little Joe's editor, Sam Ashby, to find out if and how a successful zine can hit the big time.
So Little Joe is my baby. I started the magazine in 2010, but I guess I had the concept a couple of years before that, which was for a publication about film from queer perspectives. From its kind of humble beginnings as like a zine, we've kind of expanded it and grown it into more of a kind of journal, which still has its kind of fun beginnings in the issues, but there's more of a kind of academic slant. It grows each time, and for me it becomes more grown up.
When you kind of just make that distinction between zine and journal, maybe could you describe what kind of publication it is, like what maybe about the paper stock, about the size of it. It's quite a nice little size, isn't it?
Yeah, we always wanted it to be like pocket size, and I think that kind of obviously harks back to the kind of history of zines and making your own publications with what resources you have. The first one was produced on the cheap and printed with a risograph machine. It's a kind of cross between a Xerox and a screen printer, and it's this kind of strange, loud, clunking thing which you kind of program in each layer of colour, and that's printed, and then you have to run each sheet through again for a separate colour. So we did some four-colour imagery with that, which kind of gives a nice kind of offset screen print effect.
And now we're at number four, issue number four. Tell us a bit about the theme. Each issue seems to cover a specific theme or genre or just an idea. What's number four about?
I think number four kind of came together somehow differently, in the sense that I think we kind of built up this following to this point where it became quite easy for us to kind of just approach people and ask them if they were interested in contributing something. So there was less of a kind of overarching theme for me with this issue, but I think somehow things kind of came together in a way where we ended up with a lot of German, Berlin-based stories, and quite a lot of queer, trans-specific stories as well. So I think we were kind of like, because we call ourselves the magazine about queers and cinema mostly, we kind of always wanted to fulfill the queer aspect of it. Whereas the first issue was very much kind of gay stuff, beefcake kind of material, I think we've definitely kind of fulfilled our remit a bit more with this issue.
So some of the stories that you featured in this issue, for instance, maybe talk us a little bit through some of the stories and articles.
Sure. Well, I mean, the cover images of Jane County, fabulous, formerly Wayne County, a fabulous punk icon from like the Warhol era, who's still going strong. She starred in this extraordinary, bizarre German musical called City of Lost Souls, directed by Rosa von Praunheim, who many people may have heard of. But he's a kind of affectionate German filmmaker who's 70 years old and celebrated his birthday by making 70 more films in his 70th year. And City of Lost Souls is a kind of very affectionate portrait of a group of trans women living in a pension in Berlin and working in the hovel of a restaurant downstairs and singing about their hopes and dreams. And a lot of the stories and songs are kind of based on their own lives.
And I'd like to touch a bit on the kind of paper aspect of this magazine. I think what's immediately visible with Little Joe is the kind of consideration into the aesthetic and the feel of the publication. Has that always been really important for you, as well as the content and the kind of people and the stories that you tell? It seems like a very visual aesthetic thing, product as well.
Absolutely. My background is as a graphic designer specializing in print, so I'm very interested in the sense of longevity that you get from print that you wouldn't get online. And I think the focus that we get on the articles from our readers is much greater than it would be if we just posted everything on a blog. And this idea of a kind of tangible object that you can put on your bookshelf, and I always wanted each issue to kind of exist outside of time, as if, you know, you could pick up in 10 years' time and it would still be relevant. You'd still want to unearth all these different stories that we've found. That's a huge part of it for me.
That's the story of Little Joe, is the editor, Sam Ashby, talking to our David Pleasant. Rachel, it's interesting, isn't it, listening to someone else, I guess, making that transition from zine to magazine. I guess people are going to ask you, look, Another Escape, this looks beautiful. It's obviously a great job. It's being well received. What's the secret then to making that transition? Are there any kind of, well, I guess there's probably no shortcuts, but any tips that you might have for people who might be looking to make the same journey?
I don't think there are any shortcuts. I think it's kind of a dedication. The joy of making a fanzine with zine is actually, it's quite fun. It's a good collation of material that all kind of lends to each other, but it doesn't need to kind of have that real strong editorial voice, I would say. It's much more kind of just a fun way of collating that material. Making that transition, I guess, you've got to make that commitment that it's going to be something a little bit more than that. that people can maybe relate to in a slightly different way. I think it's just got to offer something slightly different to your readership.
And Jeremy, with something like Little Joe, do you think there is a risk ever that, you know, the zines can lose something of their, you know, instinctiveness, or, you know, something of their sort of immediate, easy appeal, or when they try and make that change? Do you think there's a risk of losing a certain quality? Perhaps?
There is a risk of losing something, but there's also the opportunity to gain a lot as well. And I think in the end, I think people, if you've got the passion to produce something about a subject that's very close to your heart, then you want to be able to offer as much on that subject and do it as beautifully as you can. So I think there can be there's sometimes a bit of an artificial split, I think, between zines and magazines, and I think there's a much grayer area between the two. Actually, they you know, there's a lot of very small kind of limited run of 50 type zines, art projects, which are very, very zine-y, very consciously so. But there are others, and I think Little Joe and indeed Another Escape are examples where they start like that, but with the ambition to grow, and then they do grow. And I think so long as they keep their vision in the at front of mind, they can make the transition very successfully.
Rachel, is one of the things that changes perhaps the kind of attention to detail, that extra bit of care and attention? Is that something that changed, or I guess did you always lavish that same kind of level of love and care on your zine even before it grew into what it is now?
Well, like I said, I think before it was more kind of a fun, quick project, and it was cheap as well. I know that's another thing, and they're quite that's part of the fun of it. And then making that transition it's not just kind of a dedication in the sense of, actually, I'm really passionate about this, I want to make something real. It's kind of, you've got to start making real conscious changes that actually it's not just going to be you that's going to be seeing this, or kind of the zines that we did were kind of very limited runs. You know, people wanted them because they were fun and we had lots of people involved in them. But then to make that jump, you've really got to be dedicated to actually kind of that topic that you're going to be discussing, and know it as well. That's another thing. You kind of got to feel like you're immersed in what you're talking about and you believe it.
And I suppose the attention to detail, it never gets to the point where people maybe spot any kind of errors. Are you happy that you're error-free so far?
I would hope so. There was a lot of proofreading, but I think with most projects you're going to find something that's not quite right with it.
That kind of attention to detail is something. I mean, I think as soon as you move from stapled zine to perfect bound magazine, the buyer's expectation shifts upwards as well. So you do have to really concentrate on that detail and move upwards in quality with it.
It makes me wonder, Jeremy. I was have as fearful as my former newspaper sub-editor hat on. You know, we've all presided over like disasters. My own personal favourite, which my producer is desperate for me to relate, I managed to change the celebrated footballer Diego Maradona to be referred to as Dingo Maradona through an entire print run of a national newspaper. I take a lot of credit for that. But I wonder, are there any sort of particular gaffes that you've noticed down the years? Any sort of marquee errors that live long in the memory, or just... There's probably too many.
They are surprisingly common, and I wish I could just pull one from memory. They come from the modern way that a computer allows you to template and star sheet and everything's on the page and it looks done. And a cursory look will see there's a caption or a pull quote. You see, but it's mainly newspapers, I have to say, because of the speed of turnaround. So the Guardian... Oh,
that's the only reason it's the speed of turnaround, isn't it? It's nothing about...
And the quality of their staff, obviously.
It was interesting, I was reading, I think it was a link that you had on your blog recently about talking about Private Eye and looking at their... what is an amazingly kind of old school way that they put that together. And it's kind of nice to still see, I know there's some engagement with you know, the computer age, but there's some people who still stick to their guns and use these old fashioned techniques. Well, and it really gives the product a different kind of quality, doesn't it?
Well, Private Eye would be completely inappropriate if it turned itself into a glossy, well-made... not that it isn't well-made, but if it became overtly glossy and well-made, it would shift the complete understanding. I mean, part of it is it's fortnightly. It's you feel like it's a gossip sheet. It's thrown together. There's a kind of tabloid language. If it got too smart, it wouldn't seem real. It would lose the whole... the whole point.
Fascinating stuff. We're going to be looking through, continuing to look through your stacks of magazines in a moment, right after this.
From the historic center of pencil making to the world's biggest trade fair, Monocle Films profiles a pioneering German stationery brand taking the pencil into the 21st century.
It is more or less in our genes to make pencils. And behind this is not only the region of Nuremberg, it's also the German type of engineering, of really digging deep into things, trying to understand things and to create novelties from this deep understanding of how things are made.
Sharpening Up with Stettler, in the film section on Monocle.com.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now let's delve back into our stack of magazines appropriately enough. Rachel, what are some of the others that you've brought along today?
I very appropriately have brought The Boat with me. I've also got Flamingo and Smith Journal. Boat, I'll talk about Boat. I initially approached Boat because I love the idea of the magazine. I'm definitely somebody that's into travel, and it felt like quite a unique idea to go somewhere and actually just find stories completely about one place that actually you probably didn't know about before, or you would have to try quite hard to know that, but actually given the opportunity, very interesting stories, and they're quite diverse as well. It's not kind of looking at doom and gloom or looking at just kind of the optimistic. It's kind of giving a really balanced view on these places. So I brought that one along, and that's definitely one that I'm going to be keeping hold of and putting, you know, time and time again on my bookshelf, hopefully.
It's a really nice idea, isn't it, to take in that sense of, you know, the locality and really immerse yourself. I think there's a magazine, Local, which is doing a similar thing in the US with a lot of, you know, smaller towns, maybe off the kind of off the beaten track, and taking that same approach, really immersive and really getting into a lot of detail.
Yeah.
Do you think, Jeremy, that enough magazines do that, do get that level of detail, that kind of depth of scrutiny and analysis to really get the sense of place? Or is there a tendency, do you think, at times for magazines to kind of drop in and out of town, try and find some, you know, big ticket stories and move on?
I do think there's naturally, if you can't beat, the example of Boat you've got there is the Athens issue. You can't beat going across to Greece and actually digging locally for stories. Otherwise, you know, there's a huge infrastructure around news and stories now where you can go online and just find out what the big stories in Greece are and publish them and pretend you went to Athens. But it wouldn't be the same at all. It's very important for them. And that's part of a broader trend, I think, that was to do with avoiding the sort of easy format, the easy template. And that's what fascinates me about a lot of the smaller magazines, is that they can reach out beyond the kind of the normal way of doing things, where you always have to have a review section and a news section, and then some, you have to have a celebrity, all the sort of rules that have fallen into place over the years. The small magazines can avoid that, and they can dig deeper into one city or one situation or one subject, dogs, whatever.
Definitely dogs. Very absolutely. Happy. More than happy with that coverage.
It's going to be a boom.
It's a growth area. Tell me some of the others that you've got along.
Well, going back to formats and how you can approach subjects differently, I bought two football magazines.
Excellent.
I like my football. I picked up the first one, Field, the match day paper, last week at the match I went to. It makes a different noise to the other one, which I'll come to, but it's a free newsprint magazine in the format that football fans will recognise from match day programmes, in terms of scale. It gives reviews, previews of matches, a few interviews. It's a sampler. The guys behind it do a zine from Liverpool called Spiel. And I met with them a few months ago, and they were talking about doing this, and it's a very interesting idea. They've doing it for the last 6 weeks of the season to see if it can work, and if it's a success, they'll be distributing throughout next season at every single match, every weekend, all Premiership matches. So that's one scale. But at the other end of the scale, from America, is a magazine called Howler, which is a magazine about soccer. And it's very American. Snap.
I don't know if you have you seen this one there. Actually,
And this is made. It comes from the design agency Priest and Grace. Robert Priest is a very well-respected, actually British. He's a Brit abroad. He's based in New York. He's worked in a lot of the big magazines out there, and he's looking back at his love of football, and produced a very heavily designed, very glossy, very finished reflection of the sort of the obsession that one can get with figures and presenting facts and football. So two very, very different. They couldn't be more different, but they're about the same subject. And that, again, is, I think, one of the powerful things about magazines, is how you can approach the same subject in such different ways.
I should ask you, I mean, we've got another escape. We're talking about Serial. There's Bone Shaker, a few of these magazines from all sort of coming out the same area.
Yeah.
And with maybe similar kind of sensibilities. What do you think is behind that phenomenon? Do you think it's just a confluence of a few people, like-minded individuals, or is there something different kind of driving that kind of scene where you are?
To be quite honest, I'm actually not sure why. I mean, we're all Bristol-based magazines, and I think it's maybe just actually a city that's growing more and more confident in its creative culture. I mean, it's obviously on London, everybody knows, you know, London-centric kind of design and this kind of industry. And I think actually, I mean, maybe it is just a confidence to be like, actually, you know, we can do it from here. We don't need to be in London. So.
And Jeremy, do you think that's the case? You find these pockets of real enterprise and real, you know, creative thinking. Sometimes maybe to get outside the big traditional centres of magazine production can be something of a liberating effect, can't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I agree. I think a lot of the big capital cities, London obviously being our one, but the across Europe and the world, a lot of these magazines do come out of the capital cities, but I think increasingly you are seeing them coming out of the smaller cities. Partly because it's quite a global phenomenon, this independent publishing, in a sense, and I think people, you don't have to be in the capital anymore, you just have to have the right equipment on your desk and have a passion and an interest, and you can do it. And I think I've spoken to a lot of people making magazines, and there's quite a few people who are very fiercely both proud but of doing it from outside a big cosmopolitan centre, but also believe that because they're outside the centre, they somehow have a unique, special view and a better chance of making something that stands apart.
Just to close, I always like to ask you this when we have the benefit of your magazine wisdom with us. Any things we should kind of be looking out for? I don't know, big picture trends that you think could be influences in the next few months, or any other maybe short-term surprises around the store? You don't have any insider information, do you, about some things that may be appearing or no longer with us, anything like that? Can I pick your brain?
I'm not sure I have. You put me on the spot. I think There's certain things that are definitely happening. You know, as I mentioned, there are more magazines being launched, I find. Food isn't a huge subject at the moment. There's more and more food magazines. I think we're seeing more and more travel, case in point. These are things which allow the people making them to talk in general senses about stuff rather than just about dogs or just about football or whatever it might be, although those niches will continue to exist as well. I'm not sure I can immediately pick out a bigger trend than that. But
maybe a fusion of all those things. Maybe a dog food travel magazine. How about that? With a bit of football thrown in.
With a bit of soccer. Yeah.
Fantastic stuff. That brings us to the end of this edition of The Stack. My guests today have been Jeremy Leslie and Rachel Maria Taylor. Our producers were Dawn Trump and Adrian Craddock, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. Any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye.